Look, Matt.
Where? Oh, I see. Wow.
Oh, my.
Oh, and look over there.
Wow, is that
Ooh. Culture? Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Las Culturistas.
Ding dong! Las Culturistas calling.
I was teasing you about a surprise I had for you, my sister.
You said you would surprise me with something.
It's now time for the surprise to be revealed. And that's always the best part of the surprise, I feel, is the reveal.
The reveal. It's rule of culture.
Oh, it's rule of culture number what? Six.
Six.
Best the best part of the surprise?
Of surprise?
The reveal.
The reveal.
So I have in my hands right here, this is a result of our conversation with Rose Damu. And this is also me revealing to Rose Damu that I own these now. A reader reached out. They somehow were able to get their hands on these Joanne Trattoria World Pride t-shirts. We were given three. Okay. So these are the Joanne Trattoria Lady Gaga's restaurant World Pride
her father's
parade.
Restaurant.
Her, well, yes, we can assume that she's in some way getting some ownership over that.
What does it say on the back? I didn't read that properly. It says, okay.
There are Italians everywhere.
My God.
Because Lady Gaga, famously an Italian girl, first and foremost.
Just an Italian girl from New York. Now, let's just describe this visually to the listeners, to the readers. We have,
because podcasts are a visual medium.
The lockup is Joanne, and then this, and then Trattoria under that, a rose vector art underneath makes the Joanne a little bit illegible, to be honest. But then you have the stripes.
Okay,
of,
graphic design notes.
I'm sorry. I'm just giving them. And then it's sort of laid out as if the Joanne Trattoria is in the top left section of the U.S. flag, but the stripes instead of red, white, and blue are the pride colors and white. It says at the bottom, 2019 World Pride Parade. At the back, as we've said, there are Italians everywhere.
In bold red letters. I really, this is just, this
Thank
is a
you
collector's
to that
item.
Reader.
This is a collector's item, and there are three larges, and I'm going to bring it to you when I see you in New York, and I will see you in New York soon, and this actually is my way of getting Rose to have coffee with me.
Oh my God, you guys have to meet.
This is my gun to her proverbial head.
Yes.
To get her out of the house to get coffee with me. Girl, the culture that has sort of befallen us in the past, we could say 7 days, but really 24 hours, wild. We had the Oscar nominations, we had the Grammys.
Mm.
Now, come on now.
We were recording during the Meghan Oprah interview
really
last
shameful.
Week, so we haven't even like assessed that. But really quickly, I mean, an interview that we will talk about for a long time as a culture.
I mean, who is having that conversation?
Who
Oprah
is
really came through
that conversation?
I will say,
what?
Both of our I Don't Think So Honeys from last week were actually, without having even watched the interviews, very prescient, because mine was, I don't think so, honey, people who are only just now realizing Oprah is, quote, good at interviewing,
right.
Which was happening on Twitter.
It
and
was.
Yours was, I don't think so, honey, royal family. And I would say decidedly those are standing tall.
Absolutely. Mine was very broad. Yours was very specific. I mean, I think we balanced both of those scopes very well.
But I don't think so, honey, the royal family. They got to go, I think.
They got to go. Grammys, I thought, what an interesting night.
What an interesting night. That's not a glowing review.
I really enjoyed that the awards were evenly distributed.
Thank you. I always love whenever they don't go all to one person. I love an even distribution. And Dua got her moment. Taylor got her moment. I'm wearing my Taylor Swift sweatshirt
Taylor
to
Swift
sort of
hoodie.
Commemorate the third album of the year win for Folklore. Snaps to you, Taylor.
Snaps
you joined
to Taylor.
Legends.
Megan got awarded nicely, also arguably got snubbed at the end, but I don't think our opinion matters.
I think we can say, was Everything You Wanted by Billie Eilish the record of the year? To the Grammys, yes. To, I think, the rest of the world, probably not.
But on a production level, was it like an incredible, like, are they still like hard for Phineas? Maybe.
Incredibly hard for him.
Mr. Harry Styles got a nice moment.
And I was
as well.
Really hard for him. In fact, so hard that I had to make him my phone background. He's actually my phone background on today.
Let's see it.
That's
oh,
like,
yeah, that's
you can't really
shot.
See him because they got sort of icons in the way,
no,
but
no.
He was really looking good.
It's really wild that even through the screen, through the camera, he can radiate that. It's really wild.
It really works. Did you see the clip of him catching up with Taylor?
I did see the clip of him catching up with Taylor. They were gesticulating in a very friendly way.
Yes,
their
they were.
Their hand movements were very fun. They seem to be on good terms.
They were very, we're seeing each other and this is normal energy.
Yeah. Oh, and yeah. That's the thing. I mean, haven't we all mastered that? There is like an extra layer of conversation now where it's like, we all have to like in the moment adjust to like the pinching of the mask up, all that. There's just little ticks now that we've all
of a state of being that is conversating with the mask.
With the mask, trying to like pull it down sometimes when it's like, I want you to read my lips. And it's like a little bit dangerous.
Yeah. Or like, this is the part of conversation where I'm letting you know it's actually just me and you because I'm pulling down the mask a little bit and like sort of defying what society and the quote unquote CDC says we should be quote doing. Unquote. You understand?
The supposed CDC.
Now, before we bring the guest in, I want to know, how hard were you for the Oscars? Fully erect or like sort of chub?
Chub. Regina King got snubbed. One Night in Miami got snubbed. Otherwise, really, really fun nominations in there.
Steven.
Young Jin Yoon.
Yes.
Fantastic. And Lee Isaac Chung. Really, really fun. And the Lucas Brothers are Oscar nominees for Judas and the Black Messiah. Like, this is really fun.
The Mank boner was throbbing, for sure.
Mank boner was throbbing. But anyway, speaking of awards, we are talking to a decorated person.
Oh, Tony Award winner, among other things. And speaking of throbbing, to be honest with you, not for nothing.
Oh, my God. I said to Matt, currently throbbing?
I've been throbbing all day.
Never throbbing.
Huge. Not throbbing when it comes to this person. And this is someone who has really, really takes to being objectified gracefully, I think.
Well, I mean, it's been happening for decades. So I would imagine that he's adjusted. And if he hasn't adjusted, I'd tell him to get help.
Get help.
Because it's not going to stop anytime soon. Certainly not going to stop in the next 80 minutes.
Mm. Not at all. it's an exercise in futility to even try to, like, give you the highlights of his credits, but he's a treasure of the theater, of television, of film. Everyone, please welcome him to your ears.
Wow, you're not even gonna try. I thought you were gonna say it's an exercise in futility, but I'm gonna try.
No, you weren't even gonna try. I stand by. We're gonna get into the credits as we talk to him.
See, I know that we are, but I thought that was like sort of so bold of you because this is a legend. We have to say this is an icon.
But this is like, you know, Letterman or whoever being like, my next guest needs no introduction.
Wow. Okay,
and here he is.
Look how much throbbing he is.
But yes, it is.
Okay. No, I really don't. But I mean, go.
All right.
Well, we're about to do it anyway.
We're gonna just hash this out. Everyone, welcome.
B.D. Wong, welcome.
Hi.
Who?
Come on. You know who you are.
Hello, gentlemen. Okay,
hello, gentlemen. You want to push back against this? What are you pushing back against?
I'm definitely not like false modestying it necessarily, but I do go into a situation every once in a while where I think, well, really, do people really know?
They do.
And sometimes I'm absolutely sure they do. And then other times I'm like, I think somebody needs to kind of like maybe whisper to that person
tip them off.
Yeah.
No, they're going to know. They're going to know you from
your
something.
Your peeps.
Our people.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're in the know.
They're the right people.
Yeah. And by our people, you mean Jurassic Park fanatics. Dinosaur enthusiasts.
Mm-hmm. Matt wanted to ask you.
Oh, I have something.
But not directly.
Well, I'll let him ask.
I'm a little shy. No. I really wanted to ask. There's a million things to talk with you about, but there's something very specific that I need to know. So I am a person who, and this is one of my goals, one of my dreams, is to book a franchise big enough that there will be a theme park ride made after it. Uh-huh. So that I can be acting on the videos that play in the line for all of time. Uh-huh. You are one of the few people who has sort of achieved this. Uh-huh. So you are on a loop at all times, 24/7, BD. Uh-huh.
24/7? They don't turn it off?
Well, not 24/7, maybe some special days of the year. But let's just say if the theme park known as Universal Studios is open, then BD is performing in it.
That's right. You are
on a loop in the Jurassic World attractions.
I've never seen this, by the way. But
what?
I've never seen it. Because I think by the time, it's not that old. And then I haven't been to LA and there have been the pandemic and all that stuff. So I have not seen it.
But what was the experience of shooting the footage?
of a theme park.
Very strange, because it's way after the fact. It's not part of the movie. It has to be separate from the movie, but have to have all the approvals, and it has to adhere to all of the story points and blah, blah, blah. And look, Colin Trevorrow, the director of the Jurassic World, two of the three Jurassic World movies, has to approve of what is being said. But at the same time, costume and wardrobe and like these people are just kind of hired to do, put it together, and they kind of watch the movie and kind of recreate it, but you don't have like your real costume or, you know, that it's not like, it's not, as you can imagine, you think about it from a production standpoint, it's a whole new separate production.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. I didn't know that though, because I heard the Marvel people that it's sort of built into their, like Guardians of the Galaxy, yes. They shot footage for the Disney ride while they were shooting the new Guardians. Like, and yes. I didn't know if that was the case for you too.
It wasn't. And that was, and I think that was only just because this one was made after the fact, you know, like they, by the time they figured out that they wanted to make this ride, the movies were done or the movies were coming. They were coordinating it, but and it wasn't bad. It wasn't, it was just kind of as the performer, it's odd because you think you're done with it and then you come back and it's like, oh, okay. And then you find yourself in this strange position where you're explaining to them very basic things or reading the script and saying, yeah, I don't know. It doesn't really feel like that. Feels like the writing is exactly what he might say. So maybe I would. So then I got involved in that. So there was like writing involved.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that either, but it isn't what you would assume. Like you'd get the script and go, oh, I see. They're all fully aligned already and everything is together. They have a learning curve too, the people that are putting it together. And there are three of them. This is what's really interesting. There's a Florida one.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's open yet or not.
But you did shoot new footage for that Velocicoaster.
I did.
Okay, this is really what I wanted to ask about. Because this roller coaster looks intense, BD. You're going to have to get
super
down there.
Super intense.
Mm-hmm. You're going to have to get down there to watch yourself work.
Completely
and also...
Completely different ride.
Yes.
Completely different audience experience prior to the ride. I forget what that's called. It's got an acronym. And then, so then each team is completely different. The director and everybody, everything's just completely different.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Wild.
The first one, the one that we did had a lot of like improv and there was a little bit of a wink to it. Mm-hmm. And then I started, as the shoot went on, I got the impression they were, oh, they don't like this. They're going to like use all the very serious stuff. So I don't even know what it's like. What is it like?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, it's sort of like this. It's like we're walking through the queue and I look up to the screens and I see that it's you, BD. Yeah. And there's like a lot of children screaming around me.
Yeah.
You know what
so
I mean? So you can't really hear it. So while I think that they did appreciate all the improv, I think that they thought to themselves, well, you know, kids are going to be screaming over
this. Well, maybe it's still in there. Who knows?
And you know, you know what I hope? It's you improvising about whatever the fuck and the kids are screaming over it so that they can't even hear it. And they don't even know. You're not talking about raptors or nothing. You're talking about some crazy improv.
Exactly. I'm talking about you guys.
Exactly. I hope so.
But are the stakes lower to you? And maybe this is an unfair question, but are the stakes lower to you because it's not canonical and because to the children who are like populating these parks, they can't track what's going on in the queue? Like...
No. Well, yes and no. I mean, one has to be kind of like not, if I put everything into everything all the time, I would never make it because there's just so much, you know, I want to do a really good job and I want it to be as good as possible. And I overthink and I overcommit and like stay up too late, whatever I do to prepare. But at the same time, it is what it is after a certain point. And the best example, and Bowen, you probably appreciate this, is the third one. You know what the third one is?
Dominion.
The third park.
Oh, what is it? Oh, it's the one, the new one that they're opening. Where is it?
Hong Kong or Japan? What are you talking about?
Beijing.
Yes.
And so I had to do it in Chinese.
Oh.
And I don't speak Chinese. And I don't speak Chinese. So I had to cram Chinese. And then, of course, they dubbed me. And the onset experience for that was very upsetting because I wanted to do a good job. And I was all of my Asian American kind of shame about speaking the language and all that started like coming up. And I wanted to do as good a job as possible, but they weren't giving me the tools that I needed. They wanted to go really fast. And I had explained to them months ago, this is what I need, but I couldn't, I didn't have it. So that was disappointing to me, but, and that was a perfect example of me saying, okay, you got to let it go because yeah. it is what it is. They don't care about what you care about. They don't care about any of that stuff.
God.
So just let it go. But that was, by the time I got to the third one, I thought, oh, wow, I really, but again, another completely different ride with a completely different script and a completely different shooting thing. It's all independent.
Yeah. But this is a character, Henry Wu, who has lived on for 20 plus years.
Yeah. And can wear a black turtleneck like no other man in the world.
Well, thank you. Thanks.
Well, that's just facts.
You know, Sean Connery.
But okay. No.
May he rest in peace.
That
but
potato. No.
No. I think you've remarked on this. That character is done a little dirty at first, and maybe there is a chance for him to occupy this very impactful. I think by the time you get to Fallen Kingdom, he gets sterilized and shit.
He gets castrated professionally.
Yes.
You know, he's like taken, he's lost his license and so he's been humbled. Really arrogant in the first of the three of the Jurassic World movies. He's very, that's the black turtleneck thing. Yeah.
Yes. He was really the cock of the walk. He knew he was the hottest man in the world.
Yeah. He was basically Steve Jobs.
Basically, when you guys were just saying he was sterilized, I was like, okay, how high was I when I watched that movie? Because like, I don't remember him being sterilized, but I remember a lot of crazy shit happened. Like the little girl let the dinosaurs free at the end because she was like them too.
Yeah,
I was like, this movie is camp. I love it.
In the original novel and the mm-hmm. book, the Michael Crichton, like mm-hmm. like Henry Wu is like just like this
a
shit happens
part.
To him.
Yeah, she, huge a bunch part of it. Yeah. Yeah.
They need to beef up the role. How is it in Dominion? What can you say?
He can't say anything.
I won't say a lot, but I can say fun things. Well, first of all, just to track the whole thing, yes. I think this is one of the more interesting things that's ever happened to me, actually. Because when I was asked to come and audition for the part, I was, I read the book and I got really excited. And then they had you read scenes from the book. To audition. Oh. I forgot how it was very strange. Oh. It was not a real script. And then I got the part and I was really excited. And then I got booked for one day. And I thought, oh no.
Come on now.
What is that about? What could they do all that in one day? And I thought, no. And so then of course I hadn't read the script. And then it was one of those things where you had to go to Steve Spielberg's office, sit in the lobby, in the waiting room, read it and give it back. I read it and discovered it was a one-day part. It became that part that's in the movie. That's it. Without even an ending. Like everyone's fleeing the island and all that stuff. That person made no impact. There was no consequence to them. And I was very disappointed personally. And I also had enough of a spine at that time to think, is this an Asian American thing? Is this because there's no Asian American movie stars and I'm not one of them? And I really believed that they had to make just cuts and changes, and you know the people are all still alive. You can still ask them, but I think they didn't care about this character because he didn't appeal to the audience at that time in our cultural history, and so that was great. And then it was over, and then years later it came back around in this very weird way because they rebooted the whole thing. And I had a close friend, Nathan, who told me this would happen because he's a big fan of the franchise. And he says, it's got to come back to you. It has to come back to you. And I said, I don't see why it would or how it would, but okay. And then it did. And he was right. And the first one happened. And the first one was a complete 180 from the character that was in the original movie. Mm-hmm. And then the second movie, he's... And it, you know, kind of been brought down from that. It's like a little bit of a roller coaster. Mm. The third, all I can say is that let me just give you the landscape of why what I might have thought. I thought one of the great things about the original book was that he had this incredibly operatic death. this kind of like Wooly Wonderful kind of coming around, you know, it was like a really three-dimensional part.
Cathartic even.
Yeah. Like, yes. And I thought, wow, well, that would be great. And then of course that never happened. And I thought, well, will it happen in the first one? Will it happen in the second one? And so I'm not saying that does or doesn't happen. I'm just saying I thought that would be really one of the great things. But there are other great things too that could happen. You can imagine what they are.
Like Bryce Dallas running in a heel again. We want to see Bryce Dallas running in heels again.
That's
our big thing for the third movie. Yeah.
I can't tell you. I'm not going to comment about that. But yes, I totally understand that.
Is Laura Dern in a ponytail?
Salmon button down, maybe?
Is Sam in a hat?
No.
Okay. They're fucking up.
No, I can't even hardly remember.
This is what the gays want. Raptors are chasing you, Laura, and Bryce Dallas.
And we're all in heels.
And everyone's in heels. And everyone's wearing all salmon. Like salmon button down, but also salmon like sort of culottes, really, because culottes
like
are not the big
poplin?
Thing.
Like salmon poplin? Or salmon?
Yes, poplin.
Poplin. Crispy, and maybe Laura's is tied at the way at crop midriff.
Yes,
exactly. And we go back to Bryce Dallas's original Jurassic World hair, which is what we call the chop.
The chop. Yeah.
So we need to go back to the chop, and you all need to be in heels. You get absolutely. I'm not sure what the death is in the book, but you get ripped apart.
Yes,
and
right.
It's iconography. It's iconography the way that you die.
Yeah. Well, because this interior salmon matches the exterior sound.
Yes, exactly.
As it's being ripped. Yeah.
And it's gorgeous. It's art. It transcends.
Yes.
And then at the end, Bryce Dallas and Laura have to fight the raptors. That's what I think I want to happen.
With fists.
Yeah. They look at each other, and this is what the scriptwriters wrote. Bryce Dallas looks at Laura and she says, "Girl power." And then they fight the raptors.
They face off with it, and they win.
Exactly. And they win. Of course they win.
They like knock them out.
100%.
Okay.
And the T-Rex comes in and then looks at them and he turns the other way and runs the other way. He says, "I'm not messing with that. I'm not messing with those ladies."
And for Henry to die after six movies. Six? Am I miscounting?
No, four,
it's
right?
It's technically four, but it's technically six, but actually I don't count those other two, the ones that I'm not in.
Lost World? No.
That is a big deal for this man to survive the course of this story and to be ripped apart in salmon at the end, acting as the bridge between the generations of, you have Bryce, who's new, you have Laura, who's from the... from the old school, and then you have BD who is the connective tissue.
Right.
And remember, the dinosaurs wouldn't even be there without him.
That's right.
They would not be there without him.
Yes. And well, the thing is, my response to that is, if you can imagine the roller coaster of it, I mean, he's headed towards something. Mm-hmm. And this arrogance in the first, this kind of like creator energy, and then this whole kind of being brought down a little, something needs to happen in the third thing. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it could be related to the connection back to the original material, which is,
oh my goodness,
why, you know, his attitude about, you guys are so funny, his attitude,
we are getting it out of
where
you.
He's coming from.
As this
person. But I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to mislead or leave.
No.
You know, they say life is Goldblum in this last one?
Yes, they're all in it.
He is. They're all in it.
Wow. Yeah,
oh my God.
The three of them are hilarious. They're great together.
What, who you're talking about? Laura, Sam and Jeff?
And Jeff.
One of the icons of Lost Culture is Bryce Dallas. What is Bryce Dallas like?
Incredible. Like,
we love Bryce Dallas.
Yes. She has an incredible sense of humor. She's totally nothing but, you know, like that kind of real. There's no pretense or anything. She's extremely smart. She was the spearhead and the took a huge leadership role in the, what's the word? going into production in this movie at the early part of the pandemic.
Really?
And so she's the one that got us all together and said, okay, this is what I've found out so far about what's possible. And wow, this is what I'm saying to production about what we want, because we can't do this without absolute precautions and protocols that have to be in place. And so that, you know, because they were proposing that we would go into production, back into production, because the movie was shooting in right, January and February and then shut down like everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they came to us like in May or something and wanted us to shoot in June. Mm. And she said, I said, I can't picture that at all. I mean, I wasn't even getting out of bed. And so she was the one that got, we eventually went back in the end of July, I think it was. And which seemed really fast, but yeah, it was because mm-hmm, all of this stuff had been put into place. They really bent over backwards to get this movie finished. They wanted it done by a certain date. That was their first motivation. But then what quickly overtook that was this desire for it to be done properly, because it was the first movie to go back into production.
Yeah, y'all were back really early. Like, I remember seeing like Laura Dern's Instagram, because it was like a huge deal when she posted that she was on set, of course, her being Laura Dern and it being Jurassic Park. I remember it felt early. I was like, wow, it feels like in America, this could not happen.
That's right. That's right. And so, but that's on topic. That is the answer to the question about what's Bryce like. I mean, she has this real energy and super intelligence when it comes to laying out all the facts and compiling it. And then she has people skills to bring people together and get them to want to
do it.
Do it and to be, you know, she was a really great team leader.
That's a skill. That's wonderful. That's wonderful to hear.
We love hearing it.
This was, of course, the fourth time that I worked with her, because I did three of these movies with her. But then in 2003, I did Our Town with her at the Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor, and I played her father.
You were Bryce's dad.
Yes, I was Bryce's dad in that production of Our Town. So that was when I first kind of really fell for her, because she was so good. She was also just like out of school. You know, she was really young and fresh. Right. She went to
NYU.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was in ETW. There's photos of her in the hallway.
Not playing the family card at all. She never does that. But you know, then when you think some kids might, she certainly didn't do that.
I love to hear it.
I have a question. I mean, we're on the topic of theater. Mm-hmm. I have a specific question to ask about Pacific Overtures.
Okay.
Because I think it's really fascinating that it is this, it's a Sondheim show that is like, probably, is this fair to say, BD, like the least produced Sondheim show?
Very possibly.
Because of so many reasons, mm-hmm, there's a lot of production demands. And in terms of the casting, mm-hmm, it demands a big full cast of Asian dancers, singers, actors, what have you, and to recreate some like kabuki presentation.
Yeah.
And it's just a very layered show. And so I feel like it both like is inspiring, and it's a little bit sad that it is a show that like no one really gets, even the most like, even the biggest Sondheim freak.
Yes.
Freaks. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the one that people don't really like, they don't really engage with. And it's got some of the most beautiful music in it, and some of the most intelligent material, and some of the most spectacular everything. It's a really interesting, and it's certainly interesting to study, but it is so, this is such a rich conversation to have. Like, it's got so many layers to it. I mean, it is, let's call it what it is, a show written by two brilliant white guys, mm-hmm, about this very Japanese, you know, it was a bit of a folly for them, or kind of an experience. The way I look at it now, looking back, I used to be absolutely just in love with it from top to bottom. You know, like it could do no mm-hmm. wrong. But as I've gotten older and kind of evaluated, well, what is appropriation and mm-hmm. what does it mean to me? And when is it really, you know, if I'm applying all my rules of appropriation, Pacific Overture is in many ways like the Rodgers and Hammerstein shows of the sure. of the 50s and 60s right. appropriation. And, yeah. and it just so happens that all of these shows, I'd say The King and I and Flower Drum Song and this show, Pacific Overtures, have an integrity to them that allows their appropriation to be acceptable to us for the most part. And so this was that. And Pacific Overtures is a show which has such kind of, ambitious, intelligent, aspirations that the idea of it being appropriation is really never discussed because it's such an interesting and wonderful and beautiful show. And because it gave us a lot of jobs and because it put us, you know, we did the show.
But this is what I want to ask is that, like, what was it like working on that show and to be, because I am like, naively have until literally we did this thing over the summer. Matt and I were both involved in BD's project Songs mm-hmm. from an Unmade Bed, a song cycle that he put out in these
that was
these
really
videos.
Fun. Thank you so for having fun. Me on it.
Yes,
I was
so
honored.
Fun. But we were on a Zoom call, BD, with like all these other actors.
Yes.
And I had the terrible thought, wow, it's so incredible that there are so many Asian yeah. like Broadway performance. I was definitely like, I had no business being there, but I was like, there's so many fantastic Asian.
In this case,
and they happen to be gay.
Yeah.
Men, right. mm-hmm. gay men who were just these huge talents. And when I think about Pacific Overtures, I go, man, like it must have been a trip to like be a part mm-hmm. of that or just to have any awareness of it and think, wow, like you're led to believe that there's a dearth of this kind of performer,
yeah.
of these kinds of people who are capable of putting on this kind of show, a show that demands so much from its performers.
Yes.
And I'm like, it really fucking, I don't know, it bums me out when I think, I mean, now it's like, we know this to be true, but like, I think this moves beyond like any like cursory discussion about representation. I'm just thinking like, even now I go, wow, I didn't realize we're all out here. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, you yourself had that experience being an Asian American person was separate from, I mean, you actually had that aha moment, which surprised you and disappointed you at the same time.
For Nora?
No, just while you were sitting in the Zoom.
Yes, you were
having an aha moment that was kind of great, but also kind of sad at the same time. And it hadn't occurred to you in the same way.
Right.
It snuck up on you, I guess is what I mean. And to me, it's, there's all these different perspectives about representation and appropriation and all that. And one of them is the observance of history as it's playing out or the situation in the world as it's playing out. And then another thing, which can be very different, is how you feel about it or yes. what your involvement or what you're overlapping with it is. Pacific Overtures was 2004. Oh, yeah. I guess it was 2004. So it was after I met Bryce. And it was...
Those are your markers of time, by the way.
Well, for me too. Bryce. There's before Bryce and after Bryce as well.
Yes, exactly.
It's at NBC when I first saw The Help.
But it was 2004, and the original production was in 1975, 1976, mm-hmm. and then between that, in 1992 or so, was Miss Saigon, and Miss Saigon plays this huge role in our timeline mm-hmm. for going mm-hmm. on. Kind of creating a conversation about the casting of Asian people in general. And after right. that, say what you will about that conversation, there was a change in the way that we were taken seriously as musical theater performers, Broadway performers, and a lot of jobs came from the many years that Miss Saigon ran mm-hmm. and allowed us in many ways, not the only reason, but allowed us to establish a community of actors in New York who were musical theater performers that continues to grow and be nurtured and to strengthen itself. And you realize throughout the course of this how much the experience of doing what you're doing has to do with the building of that community. You yourself are, you know, in a situation where people say, well, how come this has taken so long? How come this has taken so long that there isn't another, there hasn't been an Asian person on SNL for ever. Mm-hmm. There never has been. And the default was always, well, there just aren't any. I mean, we just don't do that. We're not funny.
Yeah.
And the actual real answer is because we don't have a building block process or a developmental process or an educational process or an experiential process that leads us there and safely delivers us there so that the ultimate inevitability of it, it happens naturally. Mm-hmm. And that's very, like, that's a lot of things that need to be fixed in order for the world to be a better place. You know, it's like a lot of stuff that happens and creates a situation that is easily written off as a talent issue or whatever. I mean, there's also
just the issues scarcity of, issue.
Yes. There's an issue of the, our relationship to our parents and what happens to mm-hmm. our relationships with them when we either come out or decide that we're going to tell them that we're going to be actors.
Mm. Oh yeah. And then you and I have done both.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's there's similar reactions.
There's similar reactions and there's similar fears and all of that. And it's, there is, not to be super general, but there's a cultural aspect to why certain generation of Asian American parents are a little more controlling with their kids about what their future is.
Sure.
And so that's all part of swirling around in this whole thing. And then you have a show like Pacific Overtures, which creates opportunities. Miss Saigon also creates opportunities. And there's a gratefulness to them mm-hmm. that you sometimes have to kind of remind yourself is not the only, you know, that's not the only answer. It's not the answer to everything. Is someone else creating an opportunity?
The indebtedness, yes. The indebtedness is not something that it should be a fixture in the way that we think about things. Like this is a whole chapter in Kathy Park. It's the last chapter in essay in Kathy Park Hong's book, where she's like, this feeling of indebtedness that it's like, well, I should be grateful to be here is kind of a weird mental trap. But I love what you're saying about this community building, because I feel like I'm about to like make a statement about you, about your beginnings, you've built community your entire career, but also I feel like that has been informed by the fact that you started out doing M Butterfly, which was written by an Asian person.
Yes.
Like this is, I don't know, like that is the perfect example of it being a self-contained thing.
That's right.
Like,
That's one of the more graceful ways to achieve what one can achieve.
100%
is through self-generation. You know, this is why Songs from an Unmade Bed, that thing that you guys did with me last summer, was important to me, because it was self-generated and because it allowed me to express my point of view from my, without any filter of anyone else's input, and that is important for us to have a kind of purity to the journey of getting where we are trying to get. And yes, that, I don't know, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that is what it was. It was an experience with an Asian American writer. I had never had such an experience before. It was a very rare thing. It also was a play that went to Broadway written by an Asian person. I don't think there are very many other examples of such a thing, which is amazing when you think about how well Broadway is doing now. Oh, I guess, what's her name? She wrote,
Straight White Men. Young Jean Lee.
Yeah, and there are surely others, but the fact that it's not that easy to kind of list them, and they're an example of what we're talking about. And
my question is, like, were you out your entire career, or was that something that was later? And I also wanted to know if you being gay influenced your character on Law and Order also being gay, or was that just like happenstance?
I still don't know. I think it, for me, to be quite honest, I felt that was really convenient and kind of like, almost like, not like, I wouldn't call it jumping the shark, but I would say I had been on the show for 11 years And it goes to show you how thin the writing was for the character that I was playing.
Yeah.
That this was never discussed until this moment, and that they felt comfortable just lobbing it out there to serve a plot point or an argument that was happening in that situation.
Yeah. And it was your character being offended at the it was like a thing of like, there was like some sort of insinuation that like there was like a pedophile on the show they were dealing with, and the person was gay.
I don't even remember what it was.
It was weird. Yeah. It felt a little jammed in there.
Jammed in.
But I remember it being an example of representation.
Yes,
like
that's
I remember
right.
at that time everyone was talking about like what like when it was like what'd you call it, turn of the century, like around 2000-ish, where we started to see, well, I'm just saying in general, we started to see more gay characters.
Yes, that's right.
And so I remember watching something on TV that was about representation, and they were flashing through like the, I don't know, 7 or 8 gay characters on TV, and yours was one of them.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's so funny that they include that, because that's like a very, very tertiary character on that show.
Yeah.
And yet they're ticking it off as a way to pat themselves on the back in terms of representation. And I just thought that was so thin.
That is how I felt about it. And I did feel that was, it was fine for me. I just didn't think it was something to brag about. Absolutely did not think it was something to brag about. I didn't think it was unhealthy, but I did not think it was the cure to anything or you know, like, any great example of any kind of wonderfully generous thing at that point. But I was also really almost bitter or sensitive about the fact that I that's, to be super honest, why I left the show and to begin with, because the part just didn't ever sing to me at all. It was just always kind of something that the people really liked about the character was that he never changed and he always gave you exactly what you wanted. But for me, it was not particularly interesting. And so for them to have thrown that in right at the end and kind of go, yeah, that's great, right? Yeah, right. You like that, don't you? Was kind of like, oh, yeah, no, that's not what I meant. Really.
Yeah, that's not acting. That's me saying a line you wrote for you and your show. That's not it's not a way to explore the character.
Serving some ulterior purpose, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But again, I was thinking like, not only are you on a loop on like in Universal Studios Hollywood, but like probably somewhere at all times there is a Law and Order SVU playing. So I'm sure the checks don't hurt. Yeah,
they don't. And I was lucky that I got on the residual cart before it changed. Drastically in the beginning of early 2000s. So that has been good. I mean, it doesn't get bigger, it gets smaller as it goes along, but it has been really helpful to me. Yeah.
I think it's time to ask the question. Yes, it's been sustaining.
It's time to ask the question. And that question is sort of the central question, BD, of Las Culturistas, which is, what was the culture that made you say culture was for you? This is defining pop culture that you feel, in looking back on your life, made you the person that you are in some way.
And when you say the culture, you mean the object of culture or the event of culture or just...
It can be as broad or as specific as you want. It can be like the town you lived. It can be like growing up in San Francisco, or it can be like, you know, this thing that I experienced once.
This is what makes the question beautiful, is the amorphous nature of whatever you're going to say.
I think, you know, as if this was therapy, which it is not, unlike... I want to go with the first thing that pops into my mind and just follow it where it should go, right?
That's the actor's impulse.
Yes. the first thing that comes to mind is that time period when Pacific Overtures came out. It was also the same year that A Chorus Line came out. A Chorus Line came out when I was 15 or 16 years old. I had been in one or two musicals. And I was hooked on the experience of being in the musical theater and began this weird long process of thinking about doing it or, you know, it was a long process because I didn't dream of it for quite a long time. I just liked doing it. But at some point, I think to this date, even, there are not a lot, Rent, A Chorus Line, Mm-hmm. A very few national, well, Hamilton certainly, national news Broadway musicals.
Right.
Broadway
right.
musicals that became national news or that became things that people knew. And then there was a lot more touring than, of Chorus Line certainly toured for many, many decades after that. So there was an understanding of it. But the one thing that was a real moment was the star of, arguably the star of A Chorus Line, Donna McKechnie, was on the cover of Newsweek magazine.
Mm.
And I remember seeing that woman on the cover of Newsweek magazine and thinking, wow, this isn't just like some play off in the, you know, off way far. I grew up in San Francisco, and I had an awareness of the impact of the particular show on, to be dramatic, the world.
Mm.
And that there was a shifting in the medium that I was not sophisticated enough to yet to understand or appreciate or grasp, which is that Michael Bennett, the kind of legendary director of that production, was changing the form and kind of turning it in, and it reached people in a different way. And there were contemporary issues in the play. You know, of course, now they seem very quaint, but at the time there were people coming out on stage and people, you know, touching their tits and stuff. And you went, oh, wow, this is like real life kind of theater. That's also a musical that, is also still kind of oddly family entertainment. And that I wanted to be in that business. I mean, I knew somehow at a very early age that I wanted to create theater or that I wanted to be a theater actor. And I wasn't sure how or what manifestation or where it would take me. I was lucky enough when I was in high school to have a really great relationship with a high school drama teacher who really just opened the doors for me and in my own mind, you know, and kind of showed me that there were these tremendous possibilities. So at that time, and then subsequently, Chorus Line played a huge role in my recurring theme in my life. I certainly saw it every time it came to town, and it came to town many times. And then I got a job after high school as an usher at the theater where it also came, and I saw it maybe 100 times. I watched it every night.
Yeah,
I memorized it. I mean, it's a show that played, and now I look back on it and I think, wow, gee, it's not as good as I remember it to be. You know, I've actually have a kind of a come to, you know, moment where I think, well, let me evaluate it now as a grown up and a writer and a whatever, and it's still wonderful and I still have these wonderful fond memories of it, but I have a different critical eye towards it. And I...
Were you ever in it? Did you ever do it?
I was in it, yes. Do you know about this?
No. No, this is all new to me.
I was in it, but I was in it in a really powerful way. I was in the only production of it at East West Players in L.A. It was an all-Asian cast of Chorus Line.
Wow.
And it's all people that many people that I still know now and and it was that same kind of experience later, many years later, that I had with the cast of Pacific Overtures, which is, and Bowen, you might not ever have, we may not yet have had this experience, which is, well, the Zoom was the experience of being in a show with a bunch of other Asian people and without even effortlessly, there's this kind of shorthand and this sense of closeness to one another because we all have a very similar kind of pain, really. Mm. And that is just a layer of the working experience that's really, really, I wish this on anybody. Just between the breaking of bread and the rehearsal process and the kind of looking out for each other and everything, there's a real sense of understanding each other. That was the first time I had it when I was in Chorus Line at East West. And then I had it again in Pacific Overtures in 2004, like you said. And that's a really memorable color of experience.
I want to put a pin in Chorus Line, but
Yeah.
Just to the only facsimile of that I have ever had was, I've told you this, right, BD? Like, that the shooting that scene, I was in one scene of the pilot for Nora, but shooting that scene, I remember leaving that day and being like, wow, we talked about wood ears in between takes. Wood ear mushrooms. I was like, that's never happened to me before.
Yes, you mentioned that when you came from shooting it, that it was, that it had an impact on you. I remember that day.
I said out loud, and this sounds weird, but I was like, this is what white people must feel all the time. I've never, and then I looked at the call sheet. I was like, oh, look. And like the top four people on the call sheet, I was like, I've never played someone's family member.
Yes.
The lead's family member. I'm like, this is all wild. Granted, I had only been like a day player in the stuff that I had done in the past and prior to that. And even now, it's something that like is incredibly rare.
Yes, I mean, even now for me, it's there's still. I mean, I've never had a relationship with anyone in a.
You've
in
said
a
this.
Show.
Wow.
Nor was your first time dating someone, and then you're dating Jennifer Esposito.
Yes,
I love Jennifer Esposito.
And so then I went from zero loser to like the luckiest person in the whole world.
Yeah, you two hotties getting together on screen, not for nothing, Jesus.
Wait till you see the craziness that ensues in season two. It's really fun.
Wait.
Can we say that I'm having a lot of fun already this season?
Me too.
Can we say that? Okay. The vibe is so good.
It is. People say this all the time and it gets boring. It is a really very good crew. Their energy is very good and it's very conducive to comedy because you know how comedy can be just like a wet, you know, you can get like hosed down by some moment that happens off, you know, between takes, and then you're dry or you can't do what you're supposed to do. But this is very upbeat. It's very, very professional and it just works for me. I really like these people.
Yeah. Nora was making me laugh my ass. If there's a gag reel, it's going to be a good one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just because of me and Nora. No, I'm just
There's
kidding.
Always got to be a gag reel. It's a real culture. It's real culture number 91. There's always got to be a gag reel. People want to see the gags. People want to see Bowen Yang laughing. They want to see him laugh, you know? Like, I feel that people want to see Bowen laugh. Can I ask you, do you like working with Bowen? Because he can become challenging.
You're putting me on the spot.
We haven't really done it that much.
No, we haven't. We had that one scene, the woodier scene. The woodier mushrooms, scene? That was really our one like moment where we had went back and forth a few times, really. You know, we haven't had that much. We sat at the table for that other scene.
Which, that other scene, I was so out of it that, and I remember not, I remember going home that day, shooting that kitchen scene and being like, I really fucked up. I fucked up in front of Lori and Dee Dee.
He's always like that about himself.
No, but like...
It was a mood you were in, though.
It was a mood I was in, and I really felt... Because at that point, we were just beginning to, like, get to know each other.
Yeah.
And this is still probably a little present, but I'm like, man, there's something about me, like, acting opposite BD that, like, is really tripping me up just because it's him, you know? Just because this is someone who means all of these things.
Wow.
But anyway.
Yes, no need for that. I mean, look, it's really... And it was early. I mean, we were still starting to get to know each other and all of that stuff. So I understand that.
It's nerve-wracking whenever you start any project, let alone something where, like, and I mean, it is true. Like, Bowen is expressing, like, he you are BD Wong. I mean, like, it's also, like, you know, Awkwafina is, like, she is such a huge deal. Like, so I get, like, feeling like, oh, God, like, I just shot a pilot and I left a couple of days like being like, well, I hope that was good, because especially we come from live comedy and coming from theater, you're used to a reaction.
Yes.
And that reaction sustaining you going forward. And so when you act for the camera, it's obviously different because you have to move on. And I did a little tiny guest thing on the first season of Nora, and that was something I remembered about it, was like, it felt like it was professional and moving, but also that it was loose enough where the comedy could happen. And it felt like you were given a take for you. You know what I mean?
That's
like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, and that's important. Like what you're saying with comedy, it's rare to get that on the first take, because often the people that are performing the comedy on camera are people that, you know, maybe they're maybe they do come from live performance. Maybe they're cast because they are a big old fucking ham and it's going to take a take or two to get it.
Yeah.
Matt improvised a line and Nora. The most famous person in my phone is a tie between Hillary Clinton and Billie Eilish. Stupid.
Did they keep that in?
They kept it. Oh, they so did keep funny.
That in. They did keep that in. And they kept another one of my ad-libs too.
That's Matt Rodder's ad-lib.
Well, before we were talking about Nora, I just wanted to say, you're directing an episode?
He's directing an episode
directing
this season.
An episode, which is mind-blowing to me and also like a dream come true for me. And it's everything that I ever wanted. And it's really great. And it's just started today, is all the kind of pre-production and stuff. And we're, you know, it's a little crazy because I'm in this episode that's being shot while I'm doing the pre-production. And then when we get into actually shooting the episode I'm directing, I'm also in that.
Yeah.
So I'm having that what I would call the John Cameron Mitchell experience.
That might be something totally different. The John Cameron Mitchell experience.
Right. Depending upon which film you're talking about. But so I'm really into it and I'm great, really, really just so happy that I was asked and I was, it's a lot of fun. And it's, and these episodes, I think all of them, but this particular one, I really, really like it. So it's going to be easy to direct it. So that will be nice. Except that Bowen's not in it, which is not good for me.
Can I tell you I think I explicitly said
yes
to the EPs. They were like, what do you want Edmund to do season two? I was like, I just want Edmund and Wally interacting. I was like, I want scenes with Bradley, yes. Daryl, Wong.
And that shows how much they listen to you, I guess.
They did listen to
nothing. Bowen's a nobody. He's a nobody on set.
Whatever.
I said the same thing. I want the same thing. I think that would be fun. But let's just hope that it's not over yet. You know,
I think the good things are in store.
Ooh.
Yes. Yeah.
Knock
little
on wood.
Little teases.
Okay, should we close the loop on this chorus line thing?
Yeah, I want to hear your question. Sorry, I had to bring up the directing thing because I was so excited.
Of course. Oh my gosh. Of course. Favorite song? Like, is it like What I Did for Love? I feel like I gotta admit I don't know. The
I
show
know mine. Well. Mine is Music in the Mirror and the Chance to Die. I mean, bitch, have you ever seen Jane Krakowski's version of that on Ally McBeal?
No.
So a lot of gays out there don't know that Jane Krakowski sang Music in the Mirror on Ally McBeal.
I don't think I remember.
She did, and you can YouTube it, and she's stunning in it. And she gives you the whole dance number, and she fucking belts the end, and it's great. But I think that's my favorite number.
The whole thing?
What I Did for Love, a close second. Yeah, she does the whole number.
Wow.
No, I don't. I mean, I'm not really. I don't know if there are many. Is there any particular song that really is, you know, exemplifies my affection for the show. It was a whole kind of experience. I remember being just kind of like, I don't know how to call it, like impressed or my breath was slightly taken away by the fact that there was no set and there was just this black stage with numbers on it. And it just was like so bold at that time to just not have a set and all of that stuff. And it also had what appeared to be at the time, a really great quick change at the very end of the show where everybody goes from dance clothes to these like fancy costumes and there, you know, little things like that. And then there was a song about teenage angst and growing puberty, which is a really great song, which is a huge number. And I liked that, but, and also was really into the lighting. The lighting was very geometric. If you sat in the balcony, you could see all of the shapes and hard angles and colors that the Theron Musser, the lighting designer, used, which was very not like a regular musical. It was very angular. It was suited the choreography. It created shapes and spaces and different times and all kinds of different kinds of, there was a kind of lots of different usages for it. That was really great because there was no set. And so the lighting became a huge part of the transformative quality of the that element.
Wow.
You also have to listen to on Barbra Streisand. She did like a recent album, which was like, she got like movie stars to come in and sing with her.
Right, right.
And her, Anne Hathaway, and Daisy Ridley did At the Ballet.
I hope I get it?
At the Ballet. It was really good. It was really good. Wow. And the featurette, which is Barbra Streisand talking about it, is also really good. Because Barbra Streisand talking about anything is
about anything. An event.
Yeah. About anything.
Have you ever met Barbra?
I don't think I've ever met Barbra.
Well, we got to
correct
that.
I've met a lot of people in passing or whatever, but she's not one of them.
That's what I felt like I could ask you that and maybe I'd get a yes.
You might.
And out of anyone who's ever been on this show, you are the person that's most likely to have met Barbara.
Yes.
Although Will Ferrell might have met Barbara.
No, you know, I was at, I know this is going to sound so pretentious, but I was at the same White House state dinner that Barbara was at.
Wow. Whose state dinner was that?
Obama's.
Hu Jintao. And yeah, it was Hu Jintao at Obama's dinner for Hu Jintao. And I sat at Obama's table.
Wow. Did he have anything good to say?
No. No, I'm joking. I was completely tongue-tied. I mean, yeah, I never have that experience where I don't know, you know, where I usually sit down next to a stranger or whatever. This was the strangest experience. I brought my mother. She was my plus one date. And I said, to my mom, we're going to the White House. And then we got there and we were given our little fancy engraved thing with the table number 23. And we were like, great. And we're walking
through. That's a good number.
And the people there, it was like, you know, like, who was there?
Michelle.
Just people.
Michelle. Obama.
Yeah, Michelle. And and I meant was Michelle Kwan. And
That's fancy.
The architect, Maya Lin. And just people like that, you know. And so we're walking, looking for the room, and we're going with 23. I guess that's the room on the end. And we're going in the room. It's 23. I think it's that long table underneath the painting of Lincoln. And then we get there, and I'm like, and we're looking at the names. And the people at our table, it was my mother, me, Michelle, Barack, Bill, the Clintons. The Carters.
What?
John Kerry. It was Mayor Daley from Chicago. And it was the strangest thing ever. I mean,
when they were putting it all together, they were
trying to figure out who could kind of like bridge the gap or something. And my mother, who, you know, might have been a part of it too, it was the craziest thing. It was wonderful.
That's wow. So
it was
wonderful. Funny.
And I mean, we were, just to say, we were sitting at the table with the Obamas, but Barbara Streisand was in another room.
That's what I'm saying. It's so weird. Like, she was off in the bleachers. They said, F Barbara tonight. We have BD and his mom.
That's right. Yeah.
So what is conversation very casual there? Like, are they all like, hey, girl, do you see this in the news? Like, what did you think of Dancing with the Stars? Are they kind of saying that kind of chatter?
It is like that, but then it is and it isn't. You know, I mean, I sat directly across from Michelle Obama, and I couldn't think of anything that seemed worthy to discuss with her. And now I think of plenty of things that I could or would have said, but I was really like sitting there eating, just kind of, I sat next to Rosalind Carter. I was like, talking to Rosalind Carter about their foundation and stuff like that. And, oh, what is it that you're doing? And they'd gone to Syria. And, you know, and I'm like, what am I doing? You know, I'm on a TV show. Great. You know, like, it's like they're going to Syria and he's building Habitat for Humanity houses and, you know, and all that stuff.
Jimmy.
And so I felt decidedly unworthy. I was thrilled my mother was there. My mother was chatting it up with John Kerry and Mayor Daley. They got along great. She was sitting between John Kerry and Mayor Daley.
At that table because you are the closest thing we have to an Asian American president. And that is why you were there.
Exactly. Okay. You hear that, Andrew Yang?
Hear that, Andy? Oh.
Know your place.
There we go.
Stop grabbing bananas. You can't keep your hands to yourself in those bodegas, Andrew Yang. Those bananas don't want nothing to do with you. They want to be left alone.
Before we move on to I Don't Think So, Honey, I think I have a very important question to ask. BD Wong, do you think Captain Li Shang was attracted to Ping?
I would like to think that he was, but
I think this is up to you. This is up to you to say.
I know. And I don't want to disappoint anyone. And I don't want to be a coward or anything like that. Oh, but you know what? Okay, no. Fluidity is a big it's a very important thing to acknowledge.
Yeah.
Fluidity is something. When we made the movie, fluidity was not a word. We didn't talk about fluidity. Now we have fluidity. Now we can watch Shang and his choices and his actions and see it through the lens of fluidity. And this whole idea that there's a needle and it goes from 0 to 100 and it doesn't have to be in one place or another. It can move. Right. You can change your pronouns one day and change them the next day if you want. And that's good and should be the way it is. So in that case, I'm recalibrating my answer. Of course he was.
Yeah.
Of course he was.
Otherwise he wouldn't have been doing all that.
Yeah. Why would he? What other reason would there be?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's very binary to think that he was, but I did used to say, oh no, come on, you guys. That's not, don't go there. That's not right. What that is
about. That's just his very best friend. He's mentoring him.
But you know, it does remind me of the music video that Bowen was in. We texted a little bit about this, that you and the Boner Bros video.
Boner Bros.
And that the whole notion of that kind of thing that is really fluidity, I think. It's like, do you have to say it's one thing or another? Can't you just say, well, there's this kind of inclination, but it doesn't mean I'm gay, whatever. It doesn't, sure. Why can't people do that? They're really afraid to do that. They can't do it. So they have to write a song about it to kind of deflect all of their discomfort about it. And that's hilarious in its own right to me. I'm still entertained by the song, but at the same time, yes. I'm going, come on, you guys. Come on, you guys.
So we're talking about this sketch that was a pre-taped sketch on SNL, written by Beck and Kyle and Fran Gillespie. And Will Steven. It's a bachelor party in the woods, and then the strippers come, and then all the boys break out into a song about this is a highlight of their lives, that they're getting hard next to their friends.
Yeah,
that they're getting boners. That they're getting boners next to their friends. And so BD texts me the next.
That is so funny when you distill it. That's what it is.
It's what it is.
And we're all getting hard together.
And that BD rocks. And BD texts me the next. First of all, can I just out BD as like, you watch every week. You
week. And I watch a lot because of you.
Oh, come on.
I do. I want to know what you're doing, and I want to be able to discuss it with you. You know, we're not that close. Let's just call, you know, we're not.
Let's just pull the wool over. You know, not everyone in Hollywood. Not everyone in Hollywood is very close.
Yes, that's right. And but I do. And I love it. I think it's a golden age for the show. I think you're on it at a really good time. And so I'm wildly entertained by it. I certainly depended on it. And my family depended on the show in hard times in this past year, in a huge way, and during the whole Trump administration, and so there is a huge allegiance I have to it, actually.
That's nice. That's really nice to hear.
So anyway,
so BD texts me the next day being like, I got to talk to you about this boner video, and I'm like, oh, like what do you want to talk about? And he was like. He's like, were you basically saying, should I pull up the
yes,
text?
Right.
Were you basically saying that the people who wrote it are repressing something, or no, that's not what you mean?
Well, what I was kind of saying what I just said a minute or two ago, which is they see it in a very binary way. Like, I'm not gay. And so here's the irony of me getting a boner next to my.
Sure.
Bro, the fact that he is there may or may not play a part in your boner. I mean, your friend, the friend of the person singing whatever verse of the song. And it's okay. It's okay to see it that way, but it's very, no pun intended, hard for people to see it that way. They need to know they're not gay. They absolutely need to know they're not gay so that they can tell whoever that it's, and even if they had a kind of a fluid moment where they, well, let's say they always, you know, you hear about it all the time, blame alcohol or something on their actions or choices. Even if they did that, it's still something that happened. And why did it happen? And what role did the alcohol play? I think it's fascinating. I love thinking about it. And
yeah.
I think the proof, in the pudding of all of this is the way women regard this whole same issue. They're much completely different about it in many cases, if not to speak generally, but that you can have someone actually identify one way and then not identify that way anymore and then identify that way again, or have a moment of of fluidity. I just think
there's more safety.
There's blockage happening that sure. does not need to happen. I'm not saying 100%. Anything about any particular on SNL at
No.
But the fact that they are so easily slip into that role of adopting that posture is interesting.
That the joke is so easily delivered yes. through that like
filter lens. Well,
through the filter yeah. of masculinity, where masculinity is basically like self harm at this point. I feel like if you want to think about women getting together, like women syncing up their periods is not like an ironic thing. It's just this thing that's yes. like, it's like, oh, isn't that beautiful?
Yes, exactly. Right. Exactly. That's right. exactly, right. that's a right. good example, I think.
Got it.
I mean, I think that straight men should just do what gay men do. And once they get boners, they should just do what we do and just like fuck each other. It's actually fabulous. It's fabulous.
It's fabulous.
I should think try it's
fabulous.
It. Yeah.
They should try, it. And I welcome any straight man that's around me and gets a boner. Don't be scared of it.
Go with it.
I have yet to check off on my list hooking up with a straight guy, and I just got to do it before I die.
Not many people have done this.
I don't think it'll be fantastic. I just think it will be something.
Yes, and something to remember or to talk about or to, yeah.
And then, then I'll write my sketch about it.
this all goes back to Li Shang,
yes,
who must have felt something.
He did.
Yeah,
he did.
Ping is the only other male character to whom Li Shang shows affection.
Well, also remember it was Mulan the whole time. So it didn't matter. There was obviously an attraction there, and it didn't actually matter.
The gender expression did not matter.
The person. And I feel that in the new movie, the live action movie, it wasn't Li Shang. It was like a different character they used as a stand-in, but he gay.
And we'll leave it at that.
They went there? Did they go there?
No, they didn't go there, but they didn't need to because the longing looks... In live action, you can't get away with the sort of trickery of animation where it's just like, oh, he slides down the bench and he's a little too close and it's like, whoop, 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 I'm falling off the chair because I'm a little nervous to be close to you. Whoa! It's like not going to be like that. On live action, it's this guy goes into the barracks, looks at male-presenting Mulan, and I fucks the shit out of him. And you can't tell me that there wasn't something there. And I almost feel like if they released Mulan now in the way that they did, with all the panic about gender and gender expression and like what is and isn't, it would be such a controversy now. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like it would be a harder sell original. Now.
Yeah.
Yes. I really do. I think that people, conservative parents would be like fucking up the wall about it.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Right. But I also think that the what you just said is there's a perspective shift. I mean, you could see it that way. Is he seeing a man or a woman when he's eye fucking her, slash him? What is he seeing and what, why? He doesn't even know himself. We know what we know from our experience. But that's what's so beautiful about it is it doesn't matter. It's the fact is it's in some ways neither here nor there. He/she is neither one nor the other, and that's okay. And then it's okay for him to have whatever response that comes with that.
Yeah,
making a percentage, deciding what percentage of desire he has for one or the other is not useful anymore.
Mm-mm.
Really,
right.
I don't think.
How did you feel when they flew in Osmond to sing your part? Because I feel like that.
Are you allowed to talk about that? Why?
It's a long time
you are?
Ago.
Okay.
What's the relationship with Donnie?
I don't have any relationship with Donnie. I was told, first of all, I was kind of fired. You know, they brought him in, and anyone could just say any number of reasons why they brought him in, whether it was because they liked him better or they thought they wanted somebody who had he has that the perfect Disney name
Disney
for that
tenor
thing, but I
sounds.
Can't say that that's the only reason. I think they were one of the things that they said to sell it to me, to let me down easy, was, well, you know, his singing voice sounds more like your singing voice than your singing voice.
What does that mean?
It means trickery, foolishness, betrayal. Foolishness. It means true foolishness.
I just nodded and said, oh, yeah, okay.
I don't believe that for a damn second.
I'm glad I was a part of any part of it. I really was. And
it's
I let it go.
Stupid enough to say that you believe it. You know what I mean? Like, I can see you receiving that at the time and being like, oh, okay, that has to make sense. It's so dumb.
Yeah.
No! And then walking away and being like, wait a second.
Yeah.
Let's get down to business about this. How about that?
How about that? That is interesting.
That is so funny. They said your singing voice doesn't sound as much like you as Donny Osmond.
Yeah.
I think there's some emotion to this recounting that I respect you sort of withholding. Because I feel like you must have felt a certain way, but you don't have to tell us.
He obviously felt a certain way.
What? What do you mean? Like about being
fired from the song?
Oh. Well, as the singer, he still famously is the human voice,
of course. But like,
yeah. This was probably the first time in a big way where, well, you know, not that interesting, but where I was forced to deal with something that was out of my control.
Okay,
mm-hmm. And over my as a famously controlling person, or a person who what was always looking for control or gravitates towards feeling like they need it. It was a real adjustment for me. Like to go, oh shit, I don't really, there's nothing. I can't beg them. They're not going to change.
You know, sure.
So, okay. I guess I got to really just kind of like try to accept this, you know?
And they did it to Ming-Na too, right? They, because Leah Salonga sang it.
But is Ming-Na a singer? Maybe that was the thing. Where
no,
Ming-Na
she's
was
not.
The-
I don't think she is.
So she was probably not laboring.
This is always the thing that has bumped me. I mean, I've thought about this for decades at this point.
Uh-huh.
I go, why didn't they let BD sing the damn song? Because, like...
Yeah, I think maybe they didn't like the way I sang it. I don't know for sure, though.
No, it's because they're scared of the Church of Latter-day Saints. And the Church of Latter-day Saints was going to storm the ball if they didn't have their boy in it.
Mm.
Okay. That's really what it is, and that's how we're gonna end.
They couldn't wait for they couldn't wait for their own princess. They couldn't wait for the Mormon princess we're gonna get someday.
Yeah, they wait for
Mormon. Yeah,
whatever that's Mormon, gonna be, like Genie in the Lake or whatever.
Wow,
I don't know what it's gonna be.
The Mormon.
Genie in the Lake.
I don't know, bitch.
All right. Okay.
I don't know Mormon culture. Like, what are the things that they do? Like, do casinos?
They have some wild
what is
stories.
It going to be like? A casino owner's daughter that wants to be an ice skater? Like, was that going to be the Mormon Disney princess?
Yeah. Why
well,
not?
Sure.
Han says, I think we'll get hate mail for not talking about SVU. We talked about SVU, Han.
We talked about SVU, Han. So maybe you need to listen, okay? Straight.
Listen.
Is there more to say about it? You know,
No.
Okay. All right.
Unless you want to say, I cut you off.
No, I mean, it was very good to me, and I was really thankful to be on it, and it was perfect the way it was. People always want me to go back to it, and I'm not. I don't think that's going to happen.
No, don't go back. No. Can you say three words to describe Mariska?
Irreverent, dedicated, moral.
We love a moral queen.
We love an irreverent queen.
We love an irreverent moral queen.
Dedicated as well. We can't forget
dedicated. Yeah, can't forget dedicated. Okay, so Bowen, is it time?
It's time. This is think so, honey. This is our 1 minute segment.
Think so, honey.
I don't think so, honey. That's right.
He's going over it in his head.
He's going over it in his head.
Oh, okay. Sure.
An actor reads his text.
No, I'm trying. You know, I'm trying to pull up my stopwatch because I want to see my 60 seconds going by.
Oh no! We'll hold the timer up. Don't worry. Matt and I are going to go first.
This is a true control king, and it's actually a front runner for title of ep, control king.
Control king.
He wants control over the timer, but he doesn't know. We got.
No, I don't
ass.
Want control over it. I want to make sure that I see it so that I know how.
You're going to see it.
BD and I are similar in this way, where we are self-sufficient.
Yes,
and that gets mistranslated for.
Any number of things that are not...
I didn't say domineering.
All right.
I think you both should dominate me. That's how I feel.
Oh, this is I Don't Think So, Honey. This is our 1 minute segment. We take 1 minute to rail against something in culture that's really getting under our skin.
Getting Matt, do you want to go first? As it were. Yeah, I'll go first. I have something. I've been thinking about this, and it's something actually, it's actually been lifelong.
Okay. I love it.
Wow. Oh, God. I wish I could do like 20 of these, but okay.
Oh.
You'll be, on your 20th time back, you'll have done 20.
Yes, right, I will.
Good.
This is Matt Rogers' I Don't Think So, Honey. His time starts now.
I Don't Think So, Honey, Wheel of Fortune. This is a stupid game. First of all, there's no skill involved. And even if there were, no one that they cast has an ounce of it. They spin the goddamn wheel. It lands on bankrupt 8 out of 10 times. It's so fucking boring. And then they look up at the wheel. It says, it's brave. Like G blank A T. The word is goat. And they go, I'd like to solve. Glatt. It's like, so what are you fucking talking about? Also, stop buying vowels, you idiot. You're losing money. Guess C. C is in every word. Guess T. If you have a T up there, mama, guess H. If there's a Q, that's when you buy a U. These idiots guessing R when it says P blank SS. What is Prus? Stop. They are fools. You don't need any skill involved. Jeopardy is the real game. They need to give Vanna a bigger role. Pat Sajak sucks, and I'd like to solve the puzzle. I don't think so, money.
Oh, no, and that's 1 minute, and you didn't solve it right. That's not correct. Wow, that is brave. Oh, Matt, that is one of your best.
I'm in trouble.
I constantly watch Wheel of Fortune, and I'm like, after Jeopardy, you're going to put on this? This fucking, it's like, watching a New York Times crossword puzzle and then watching kids play hopscotch. It's like, get the hell out of here.
Those are the poles. Those are the sides of the same coin.
After you lube up, you don't go play checkers. And Jeopardy is getting you lubed up, and then you want to get fucked, and then they give you Wheel of Fortune.
That is a very interesting way to look at it.
Listen, after Jeopardy, I'm loose and I'm thinking, let's go. And then they put Wheel of Fortune. Loose, though. No, never. Okay. Never. never.
That was brave. And I love this world in which the answers are 4-letter words. Go.
Bowen, you would be blown away. In fact,
no, of course. No, I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's a funny thing to YouTube, like, Wheel of Fortune fails.
Yes.
And see when they really need to, it's really impossible to get it wrong. And they're like, I'd like to solve the puzzle. Chicken ran. And it's like, no, it was chicken run. And whenever Pat Sajak is like, oh, that sucks. You are really dumb.
Yeah.
So it is funny for that reason, but I think the game is stupid. The prizes are so small. They're winning no money. It's like they leave with like $12,000 and they're like, cool.
And it's like the longest running show in the history of the world.
Vanna White, the poor woman, does she like her life? We'll never know. But one time we did one time on this show explore what the inner life of we think Vanna is, and it's actually quite dramatic.
It actually lends itself well to a play, BD, if you want to produce.
If I'm looking for rich material.
Yeah, if you're looking for rich material, we've actually basically already scripted the whole Vanna White play, so we'll be in touch.
Wait, honestly, but really quickly, this isn't even a pitch. I just want to get BD's thoughts. Mm-hmm. I think it's a play that is a game show.
Set in a game show or a game show?
Set in a game show, and you're seeing the game show play out, but then there's like, the staging of it is such that like there's like a backstage area in which like the politics between these two like the dynamic between these two hosts is a little toxic and combative.
Oh yeah, so that you see the backstage antics and then you see them on screen and see them covering up or being kind of like what they present to everyone else.
Yes. Yeah.
On stage, backstage. Right.
But meanwhile her life is crumbling.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes. And he's toxic.
And he's toxic, and she's been at this job for decades at this point, and her only job is to be silent and look pretty.
And you know, if you think about it, the spinning of the wheel is actually really a good metaphor, because what are they doing if not spinning their wheels every day? And that's what's so beautiful about it.
So they never get anywhere. They're just...
Nope.
Just, oh, it's like a hand...
Because that's not what happens in a circle. It's actually rule of culture number 13. You never get anywhere.
That's not what happens in a circle.
No.
All right. This is... Okay, I think it's time for me. Please.
I think it's time for Bowen Yang. Oh my God, look, I just pulled it up and look at Harry. I'm so you're happy not, that's my phone back there. Look at how hot he is. Jesus.
I mean, who could get away with that outfit? When we were watching that, I was going, okay, that is success, man.
Yeah.
That is sick. I don't know anybody that could wear that the way, quite the way.
It's a genius look. And genius. Then he was covering up with these boas. And I almost came in here and did I Don't Think So, Honey, Harry's boas. Because I feel the boas are a hat on a hat.
I know, but you didn't feel that strongly about it.
No, I didn't feel that strongly. I mean, he can really wear whatever he wants or as little as he wants. But I do love the opportunity to see his torso. So the boa was in the way for me personally.
Well, there was a reveal.
Exactly. And we love that.
Yeah.
The reveal was satisfying.
Exactly. And that's theater.
The road comes back.
That's theater.
And yes. So, Bowen, this is going to be your time to do I Don't Think So, Honey. And Can I say you're backlit in a very, like, sort of, like, glamorous way right now? Like,
I'm front lit.
You have backlighting, too, and the aesthetic is very good. So,
there's a little flare. Happy for you. There's a little flare on the lens practical flare. Light. Yeah, lens
on
flare.
The lens.
Like a goddamn J.J. Abrams movie in the Zoom.
Star Trek. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. If we're so lucky. All right. So, this is Bowen Yang's I Don't Think So, Honey, and his time starts now.
I Don't Think So, Honey, construction. What are you doing? We have the buildings we need for the rest of humanity. And this is actually true. There is enough space for every person in this world to be housed, to live in. But I'm not going to make it about, a houseless situation. I'm saying stop building things because it's actually ruining people's lives, mine included.
30 seconds.
I did not pay to have noise. And I know this is such a hackneyed New York complaint, but it's this enduring one for a reason because they think they can get away with it because they think this is part of New York life is that you have to put up with construction. Actually, we don't. New York is fine the way it is building wise. We don't need any new developments. We don't need any new crazy buildings. I don't want all of these dorms for adults and finance bros specifically built around the city anymore.
Dorms for adults. I don't think so, dorms honey. That was Bowen Yang's 1 minute. And
it's how they're marketing these buildings to people now. It's like, well, there's a pool table in the common area. It's like,
yes, amenities.
But it's not even amenities to me are like washer and dryer and unit, no, dishwasher.
No.
It's like movie theater. There's a theater.
Yeah, that's right. Peloton.
Peloton room. There's a gym and a Peloton room now.
Yeah.
That's how it is. That's how it is.
I'm afraid of doing this. I'm so afraid of doing this.
Why would you be afraid?
Because you've done it many times and because I don't know.
Bowen, can you handle this? This
yes,
is ridiculous.
Please handle. This happens all the time, right?
What happens all the time is that Matt and I do it and our I Don't Think So, Honey, at this point, are like C pluses throughout.
Eh.
Like the people who are novel at it are actually the ones who like are able to bring some electric active thing to it.
Oh, dear.
And they come in and they hem and haw. Meanwhile, I just did one on a 40-year-old game show. Bowen did it on construction. Neither of us are going to get anything done with this. Wheel of Fortune's not going anywhere. Cuomo's got his hands full. So it's like... What the hell? You have an opportunity to enact change right now.
You really do.
I don't think I'm going to enact change. I'm just going to be, you know, I mean, I have to be as honest as I can about a situation. You know, I try not to be angry about things. So here, when I'm angry about something, I'm going to just talk about what I'm angry about. You know, I
mean, okay, good. And this is your opportunity.
Irksome or irked.
Here we go. Yes. Irks is a great way to put it.
Perfect. Right, this is BD Wong's I Don't Think So, Honey. His time starts now.
I don't think so, honey. I mean, I know that I'm late to this party, but crime scene vanishing at the Cecil Hotel is something that I cannot abide. This is 4 hours or more of time that I will never, ever, ever get back in my life. I first should say,
you watched
as
all of it.
Part of my presentation that the soul of Elisa Lam must be spinning in her grave, and we must take a moment to say that this was all based on this kind of commercialized, overhyped, and poorly produced production. Was at her expense. And I find that absolutely terrible. There was to get in even into the whole terrible other aspect of it, which is the problem of paying attention to too much people on the internet. That should stop right now. I don't think so, honey.
Yeah,
and that's 1 minute.
Well done. And you're actually very topical. You're very topical. Okay. Very topical. We've discussed on this very podcast that Bowen does not think so, honey, this.
Oh, okay.
That it the only thing that the show unintentionally does well is to talk about the culture around crime now, around true crime now.
Unintentionally.
Unintentionally, because it was such drivel the way it was made.
Garbage. I was so... I'm really mad about it. I think you've already talked about this. I know other people already heard about it.
No, we want to hear what you say.
Well, I mean, it was absolutely irresponsible, and it was manipulated, like kind of like taking facts and just trying to make a narrative out of them that didn't exist. You could see it. It was also stretched beyond.
Oh my God!
Just stretched, hopelessly stretched.
Yes.
And I'm critical of things like this, or things that are if I feel like I get ahead of something or something like that, but I really felt this was intelligence insulting for most people.
Do you feel that we have hit the breaking point with true crime, where maybe it's just like we all need a break? Cuz I feel like the reason why it was bad is because they were like, "Oh, we have an opportunity to do a true crime thing. Like, let's do it," without really thinking about the case, whether or not it was appropriate or like would fit.
Yeah, I mean, yes, of course. Yes, yeah. I think that. I mean, I was now on my, the algorithm on my Netflix, all this true crime is coming up, and it's all Netflix produced, and I'm over it. I'm like, well, I'm not watching any more of those, because you blew your credibility on that one. There are other ones, like if it was in, certain other shows that I've seen in other places, when they produce them well, you want to see that content. But this really damaged me. I felt really abused by it.
I agree.
That sucks.
And this is specific, but were you not heartbroken when they cut to the parents?
Yes.
Anytime they like showed the parent, I was just like, God, these two Canadian Asian people who like immigrants, like who like have no idea about any of this.
Got on a plane or wherever, whatever, however they got here, and just got thrown into this horrible, horrible. And the show doesn't, and clearly they didn't want to be involved. They didn't attach themselves to it. They've extricated themselves from it, and there's a reason for it, because it's not good, and it wasn't going to serve them well, or her, their daughter. She was not served well. She was manipulated and turned into some kind of bizarre character, when in fact she had real challenges in her life, apparently, if you were to believe everything you saw on the show. And that's terrible too. That's like, what are we doing? Who did that and didn't think twice about it? It takes a lot of people to make a show like this, and somebody didn't raise their hand and say, "Hey, what are we actually trying to do here?"
Yeah. We've talked about it so much that I'm like, I need to watch it, but everything we've said has been negative, so I guess I'm not going to watch this.
No,
I don't need it.
I could not recommend it less. Is that
Yeah.
I wouldn't say watch it just for the research or like, oh, so that we can talk about it. I would say it's a waste of time.
Yeah.
Did you watch The Vow?
I did watch The Vow. And I watched the other one on...
Seduce. See, and I want to say ever something to the readers. Mm. If you, like me and Bowen, got exhausted by The Vow, you gotta watch Seduce. Seduce is better. And you know who brought Seduce to my attention? Molly Shannon, in the makeup trailer, was like, you have to watch Seduce. Molly loves like all reality shows, like all this stuff. And she was like, no, don't watch The Vow. Don't watch The Vow. Watch Seduced. And I watched Seduced, and she was right. And I'm telling you, BD knows Seduced was better. Would you agree?
I think that there was something really not right about The Vow. I kind of got into it for the first part. I was really, and I did like
the way they
positioned The Vow. Where they led us into this whole thing by showing us what was great, or what apparently seemed like it was great about the program. And then you got pulled into it just the way everyone else did.
Yes.
And then this other Seduced is like a 180 kind of weird. It's a fascinating different perspective to have. The only thing that kind of bugs me about seduced is that it's self-produced by the person who's trying to make their point.
India Oxenberg.
Yeah.
Right.
And that is like, there's long, I said, there's all these long kind of her talking to the camera, right?
Yeah.
And I said to Riker, my husband, I said, there's nobody there in the room with her. She's just talking to the camera. She's doing like totally Valerie Cherish. She's sitting there telling her story.
I did feel like the way that she was saying the lines, I was like, is she being directed badly or is she just
like
rehearsed?
That, right?
She definitely isn't a natural on-screen presence, but it was really interesting. Like, Seduced was just 4 episodes. It was just like the facts. They have Keith Raniere on camera saying things like, you know, kids actually want to be raped.
Yeah, yeah.
He's literally saying things like this. Meanwhile, The Vow only kind of alludes to that.
Or maybe it
gets to it later. And I feel like there was an ego pump in The Vow because it was people that were involved in it that were part of that thing administratively that felt like they really needed to dig themselves out of it with more. Meanwhile, Seduced, it's 4 episodes. They literally show him on camera being a monster and you get a direct perspective from someone who was like truly victimized by it.
Yeah.
So it's just, I preferred Seduced and I say that to the readers.
As an audience member. And also, at the end of the day, neither one's some great documentary filmmaking.
No,
you're looking for that, then don't watch either of them.
To compare India to Valerie Cherish is inspired though.
It's inspired.
We love that. That's the perfect intersection of culture that we talk about here on Pop Culture East.
Okay,
and a brilliant way to cap off an episode that has been our true joy. We thank you so much for coming on. Quote Wendy Williams,
He's got a point.
He's an icon. He's a legend.
He's a legend. And he is the moment. Now, come on. It's BD Wong.
I love you guys.
We love you so much. Someone who, I don't know, and the girls say this now in a facetious way, like, that person is the blueprint. This is someone who is the blueprint, knows that it's about community building, because they say before you don't think about building a career, think about building a community. Everything that BD does is about that at its root. And it's I hate saying this word, but it's so inspiring.
But we do have to end every episode with a song.
Okay.
Oh, who's we?
Life is a willow and it bent right to your wind. Now you do the next one. He's still not off book on Evermore, everybody. He's gonna take a week to get off book on Evermore, but for now, bye.
Bye. Bye.